Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is there to look forward to about growing very old? Given the anxiety many of us have about declining physical health, cognitive ability, and independence, imagining our lives in the decades to come can be a sobering and even frightening exercise. But my guest today has spent much of his career caring for patients in their final years and has come to believe those years promise sweetness as well as struggle. Dr. Mark Agronin is the adult and geriatric psychiatrist for Miami Jewish Health Systems. His new book is called How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old. Mark, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You quote a great conversation in the book talking to the 77-year-old actress Julie Newmar. Can you tell us what she said to you?
Sure. People might remember Julie Newmar from the old Batman series in the late 60s. She was Catwoman. But in addition to that, she was an actress in the 50s and 60s and many, many well-known movies. An amazing individual. She's quite active. She blogs. She lectures. She writes. And I spoke to her about some of the changes in her own life as she's gotten older. Like so many individuals, she's faced changes physically, but she's been able to really overcome those. What she said is that if you write a book on aging, its pages should be blank, because she felt that there's so much to be written and so much that we can do, she really didn't want to prejudice ahead of time. And I thought that was such a wonderful way to characterize it, because it really speaks to the opportunities people have as they get older. We tend to focus too much on the downside and on some of the losses, but she really reminded me that there's a lot more to it than that.
And there's also this idea that, you know, what seems like a horrible loss to us in our 30s or 40s might be more tolerable in some ways as we get older, or things seem somehow more normal.
Well, it's true. When we think about later life, we can only think from the age that we're at. And so when you're 18 and you look at someone who's 40 and 50, they might seem pretty ancient. And yet when you get to 40 or 50, it seems like the most normal of times. So a lot of what we think about aging is a projection of some of our own fears. And yet when you look at what older individuals have to say, the vast majority report that stress and worry actually decrease. Surveys indicate that levels of well-being actually hit a peak later in life, contrary to what we may think. And it's true to the point that you made, that often we're able to better cope with so many different challenges as we get older. Think about it from this perspective. We have more experience, more knowledge, and we also have the potential to develop a broader way of thinking about decision-making and daily experiences, something that we call wisdom.
We talked to Susan Jacoby last week, and she wrote recently a much more negative book about very old age. And she pointed out that in some of those surveys, people are not asked anything after they turn about 85. Is it your experience that once people hit a certain point, their level of satisfaction drops off?
Well, not that we've seen. And it is true that the surveys often stop at a certain point. But there have been research studies which have looked at individuals beyond the age of 85 in their 90s. There's been a tremendous amount of study of centenarians, or individuals who are 100, which continue to show a lot of the same trends, that individuals tend to look at experience in a more positive perspective. They tend to be more emotionally satisfied and mature. There's no question that individuals can face tremendous challenges as they get older, which can really color everything that they experience, and I certainly would never deny that. In fact, in my daily work, since I work as the psychiatrist at a long-term care institution, I see really the worst-case scenarios. But I also see within those scenarios that there's always things we can do to better someone's situation, and it's that possibility that I really emphasize throughout the book.
You write about this, that the medical community at large tends to sort of give up too soon in trying to help elderly people who have mental problems. And I think this is so interesting, because it does seem that people assume that past a certain age, somehow maybe you can't get any better. And that's not been your experience as a physician at all.
Well, that's true. And a lot of what I write about in the book is how as a physician, I've had to face my own doubts and at times even my own despair over being able to make a difference for someone.
Yeah.
These are very complex situations that we often face later in life. But the key thing is to be persistent, to not give up. And even in very, very difficult situations, we find that there are ways to improve it somewhat. I was thinking about this just this morning because the wife of a patient came in, and she brought me this beautiful essay that her granddaughter had written about her grandfather who was suffering from Alzheimer's disease. And I thought, this is someone who, when he first came to me, had memory impairment, he's had physical impairment, he's on tons of medications, he had agitation, delusions, hallucinations, as much as you can throw into the picture he was suffering from. And yet after working with him and working with the family over time, he's really doing wonderfully. And so it just, again, emphasizes this point that we simply can't give up, especially as physicians. If we simply throw our hands up and say, well, this is how aging is, it can be pretty terrible, then we really miss half of the picture. It's not a matter of denying the downside. It's a matter of balancing it out with the opportunities that people also have and their strengths as well.
Talk about the clinical evidence here. Is there a point at which people with advanced Alzheimer's really are so far advanced in their disease that they don't know to be unhappy, or does it need to be actively managed in terms of their ability to be satisfied with whatever cognitive ability they have left?
The natural course of Alzheimer's disease ranges anywhere between 8 and 12 years. So this is a long-term illness, which is, for many individuals, what becomes so tragic with it. As people progress, their insight tends to drop away. And so it's very unusual for someone, once they get into the middle stages, to really have a sense for the fact that they're suffering from memory impairment. In fact, sometimes I see individuals who deny it completely. What we end up doing is managing changes in mood and behavior. Mm-hmm. It's really only into the very, very final stage, maybe the last 6 months, that individuals are in such a debilitated state that it's very difficult to reach them other than simply through touch or through the senses. So you have to consider that's the last 6 months of what may be a decade-long process, and we have to take advantage of the fact that throughout the vast majority of the course, we can be involved with someone and keep them vitally involved in different things, and remembering the fact that memory impairment is only one aspect of the disease, and there are strengths that people retain even through the final stages, the ability to enjoy humor, to be creative, to connect with other people. If we can focus on these strengths, we can really make a significant difference in the quality of life.
What do you have to do in caring for these patients to make sure that their families are doing okay?
It's always a matter of engaging with both the individual and their family over a period of time. I make the point in my practice that getting treatment for whether it's Alzheimer's disease or any other form of illness in late life has to be more than just an episode. It has to be a process. And so if the physician can get to know the person behind the disease, or for that same matter, for caregivers and family members to still retain the knowledge of what this person was like and what their strengths are, it's a way to get above and beyond some of the challenges that we face. And it's extraordinary sometimes the difference that it can make.
Is it easier for you in some ways when you first meet a patient to get a sense of that person as an individual, even if they're already suffering some decline, in that you're not trying to compare them with what they were at 50?
Well, it's true. I never begin an interview with what's the problem or why are you here. I like to begin it with, tell me about yourself. Where are you from? What's important to you? What do you enjoy doing? Because often with individuals, as they progress through any form of a memory disorder, long-term memory is retained throughout most of the illness. And so they often can talk about very meaningful, important aspects of their life, and it gives them a sense of confidence and a sense of self-esteem, and it helps them build a connection with you. It's true, I don't know what they were like before, and sometimes it can be difficult to imagine the changes they've gone through, but at least it gives us a way to connect and to form a bond. And for me, that's one of the most wonderful and most inspiring aspects of working with older individuals, regardless of what they're facing.
A significant number of your patients have been Holocaust survivors over the years, and I thought it was very poignant. You write about at least one whose loss of some memory ability sort of freed her from a lot of day-to-day guilt and pain and sorrow in these terrible memories. And it had never occurred to me that there may be things, there may be some advantages to people who have suffered for so long in not remembering as clearly as we used to.
This is one of the paradoxes of a memory disorder, that sometimes as people progress through it, at the same time that they're losing aspects of their identity, they're also losing some of the attachments they might have to lifelong worries or traumas that they had. And so it's somewhat bittersweet because, on the one hand, they might not be as concerned about the terrible tragedy. Now, this is particularly true for individuals who suffered from during the Holocaust or wartime. But at the same time, they might not be able to articulate how they're feeling to the same degree. So it's a mixed picture. But with this particular woman, this is someone who suffered terrible trauma, had lost three of her four children during the war, and really kept that with her for so long. It was only in the final year of her life, when she was having more memory impairment, that she really began to separate from some of these concerns.
Does having gone through something so terrible make people somehow more resilient as they get to old age and are dealing with different kinds of losses?
This is what I always used to think. And I would imagine that if someone has survived wartime or they've survived a concentration camp, that it really meant they were so resilient and they would be able to have an advantage when facing the different stresses and challenges with late life. What I learned is that it's not always the case, because for some individuals, the challenges in late life can reawaken some of the trauma that they dealt with in the past and maybe had adapted to. The other thing is, some individuals, they don't want to feel like a victim again. For them, enough is enough, and even small indignities as they get older can have disproportionate effects for them. So I'm very careful not to make any assumptions about what someone is experiencing, and so I really have gotten to know them, have talked to the family, and heard from them what their experience is like.
You also take pains here to point out that even as some of your older patients seem to become more childlike in the way they respond to things and behave, you are always aware that they are not children.
Exactly. Everyone has strengths at the same time they have weaknesses. And if you only focus on the weakness, or that's all that you look at when working with someone, sometimes that's all you're going to see, and they'll act that out. I found this particularly impressive when we started a group for women suffering from early memory disorders. I see them in my clinic. When they come alone or with a single caregiver, they're often somewhat timid, they're anxious, and they know that the focus is on their memory loss. When I went to see this same group of patients, but together in a group with other women, it was remarkable. And I talk about this in one of the chapters in the book. They were laughing. They were having discussions together. They were focusing on everything but their short-term memory issues. And I saw a transformation. I saw what I referred to as a true strength in numbers. And if we can enable similar experiences for individuals, whether it's memory impairment or other aspects of impairment as they get older, we can really bring a change for them. Just the opportunity for someone to give back to others can be liberating, and it doesn't matter whether they have a memory impairment or a physical disability. To feel useful, to feel that you can make a contribution, that you have value, that in itself is healing for so many different individuals.
Dr. Mark Agronin is my guest. He's a geriatric psychiatrist for Miami Jewish Health Systems and author of the new book, How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old. Join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Mark Agronin. He's a geriatric psychiatrist with Miami Jewish Health Systems, and he's written a new book called How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. You tell a charming story in here about your youngest son asking you when he was four about what your work was. And he wanted to know, ultimately, what is old and in how many days will I be old? I thought about this, and I'm 40, but I would also like to know the answer to those questions. What did you tell him?
Well, obviously, the explanation to a four-year-old would be different than what I might tell patients. At the time, he had actually woken me up in the morning with these rather sophisticated questions about what old is and how many days do you count to be old. And what I told him is that I talked about actually his grandparents and how as people continue to live, they have changes, and that's what being old is about. And for a four-year-old, he can really see it in terms of counting, so I kept it on that level with him. But when I speak about this in a more general sense, I talk about what old is from two different perspectives, one being the physical changes we face, which are unchangeable and which have a predictable pattern and limits. And then I talk about people who age and the psychological process of aging, which can be quite different and can go above and beyond many of the physical changes. I like to describe aging as something that can give even as it takes away, because we often face this paradox where individuals might be facing declines in memory and other cognitive skills. At the same time, they're gaining in knowledge and experience and emotional maturity. Think about if you compare yourself from, say, age 18 to age 40, I think most of us would agree that we're pretty much the same person in terms of our personality. And yet when we think about how we make decisions, we might agree that, boy, we really are quite different. We have so much more wisdom and ability to do this. And we have the potential for this to grow and change as we get older.
Is there any value to sort of denying the reality of being old? I often think about my grandmother, who lived to be 90, and she was like a wound-up clock. Her brain was great, her body was great, and then she got cancer and died within a matter of weeks. But for the most of her life, she was happy, and she would always talk about other people younger than she was as old folks.
Sure. Well, this is a perfect example about how we all of us define aging by our own perspective, and I think that's good. Not to be caught up with how other people describe it or what it necessarily is. And I found this too, because I often ask my patients, now the average age I treat is about 90, so I see lots of individuals in their late 90s and above, and I like asking that question. I'm so curious, what is it like for them growing old? The responses are as diverse as the individuals, and I think that's important. One thing that I've learned is that the way we think about growing old has a lot to do with how we experience it. And so the more positive we tend to be, the more we focus on our strengths, it really becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in that sense. I don't think by the same token it's good to, if we get older, to really put it down, to take on some of the same prejudices that young people get. And I think about this sometimes. A colleague told me that his mother recently was admitted to a long-term care institution, and she basically said, oh, I can't stand being around all these old ladies. And yet this woman is in her 90s herself.
Yeah.
On the one hand, maybe it's not bad that she's asserting her independence and her somewhat youthful reflection, but it also, to me, suggests that she has a very negative view of aging, and it might cut off some of the opportunities she could have to really feel kinship and mutual strengths with so many other people who are around her.
That was a really interesting element of the book, was the idea, you know, everyone, justifiably or not, a lot of people think of being put in a, you know, what we sort of call a nursing home in a rude way is
sure.
A terrible thing. And yet you have found people forging friendships, supporting one another, falling in love.
Of course, of course. We look at nursing homes too often as places where people go to die, as places you'd never want to go to. And yet I speak from someone who works in a nursing home every single day. And I see individuals come here to live, to thrive, to get needed care, and to really build a community here. I don't think there's anything inherent about a nursing home that makes it bad. It's really what we bring to it, and we certainly need to do better in that area. I can take you to places in a nursing home, and you will find this anywhere, where you'll see one room where the family is actively involved with the resident. They make the room look like home. They visit. They maintain involvement. In another room where you see none of that, and it really is a very cold and lonely existence. This is not a problem of age per se. It's really a problem with how we maintain or don't maintain our connections with our elders.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour, Mark Gronin. The new book is called How We Age. Let's go on the phones to Kim in Denton. Hi, Kim.
Hello. I wanted to make a comment about my grandmother and my mother. We don't have Alzheimer's. It's my understanding that it's somewhat genetic, and we've never had an Alzheimer's history in our family. And one thing I've always noticed about my grandmother and my mother, both of whom are deceased, is that they always surrounded themselves with younger women and young girls. My mother started a social service agency that worked with teenagers in the inner city, teaching them how to cook and how to type. And my grandmother, in her 80s, was teaching Spanish to young women in the neighborhood. And they were always very, very active. And I remember when I was in school once, a psychologist saying, surround yourselves with young people because you need their irritation to keep you young.
What do you think, Mark?
I think that's a great point. And you're pointing out some key personality characteristics, that you come from a family of very deep altruism, a deep desire to give back to other people. I think this continues throughout a lifetime, and I find this often when I meet someone who's older, who tends to be a very kind, giving person, that if I find out what they were like 30, 40 years ago, it's pretty much the same. And by the same token, we have this terrible notion of someone being a grumpy old person. Usually when you meet someone like that, they've been grumpy for a long time, and you're looking more at personality. So your family sounds very blessed to have these characteristics, and I would be willing to bet that whether they're surrounding themselves and working with younger people or old people, they have so much to contribute and are able to provide such benefit for other individuals that it really gives them a feeling of vitality regardless of age.
Mentioning that people are pretty much who they were as younger people, but maybe more magnified in old age, makes me think, though, of the story that you tell about a patient you call Mr. Summerhill. Can you tell us about him?
Yes, this was probably one of the most challenging cases I've ever faced. Mr. Summerhill was very successful, very wealthy man, but had suffered from terrible alcoholism and hit a point in his mid-70s where he just lost control and ended up he stopped drinking, had a seizure, and what really emerged when he stopped drinking was an underlying bipolar disorder. He became quite manic and just out of control. I think it was about 2 years that I wrestled with someone with very, very severe mental health issues. If someone would want to see a picture of the ravages of aging, he was a picture of that, and I wasn't sure what would emerge over time. What's remarkable is that by staying committed to him, by getting a team involved, by working with him, he slowly recovered. We found the best medication regimen for him. He threw himself into AA. He's been sober now. He had a complete turnaround. In fact, I just saw him a few weeks ago. He's back to managing his finances. He's actually involved in an international project in Haiti. You would have seen him 2 years ago, and you would have written him off and said, this is an older man who is simply not going to make it. And yet, this idea of being persistent, of not assuming that someone can't get better, and of staying involved, holding on tightly, made all the difference for him. And I would suggest that we have this potential with so many individuals that we otherwise write off.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Laura in Fort Worth. Hi, Laura.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 91-year-old retired colonel father-in-law he lives next door to us, and he wants to age in place. He probably has moderate dementia, and the main problem that I see is that as a former POW, his mind is more and more stuck in World War II and POW camp. He's living the memories of the joyful years with his wife and their routines. And I just wonder, is there anything that we can do to keep the sweet part of him there? Because I don't think we can let him age in place much longer because we can't provide him with those routines of daily living that an older person needs.
This is a very common scenario that I see. I work with a lot of World War II veterans, many of whom were combat veterans and who suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. And sometimes in the early stages of memory impairment, some of the symptoms can reemerge from past years. It's important to take a step back and ask the question, why is he experiencing some of these issues? What's triggering them, and can we intervene? So, for instance, if there is untreated pain or untreated depression, these might be driving some of those symptoms. And pain and depression are two things that there are a lot of good treatments for. Has he had an evaluation for his memory impairment, and has it been thorough? Sometimes there are medications that can help relieve that. Does he need a little bit more support at home, someone to visit him on a regular basis? I've seen individuals, even with early-stage memory impairment, do wonderfully with individual counseling. This is a generation that isn't used to the idea of psychotherapy or seeing psychiatrists. There's still a tremendous stigma of that to them. And yet when they get involved in it, they often embrace it and find it liberating. So I would say you have to be persistent in the situation, and you're not going to cure aging. You can't remove the fact that he's been through trauma before, but there are always ways that you can make a difference in some critical aspects of his life to improve it and to get him back to where you knew he was before, or at least to approximate that.
Mark, how do you tease out sadness from either decline in function or independence or grief from clinical depression? And does that matter in terms of how you would approach treating it for a patient who's in psychological
sure.
pain?
It's actually a critical distinction. Depression is not a normal part of aging. Depression is a disease state. Depression is more than just someone feeling sad or down, but it's persistence of those emotions almost every day for an extended period of time. But we also look for change in appetite, in sleep, in concentration, in interest level. Are there suicidal thoughts cropping up? When we see that larger spectrum of changes in a person, we begin to suspect that this is more of a depression. And under those circumstances, sometimes a trial of an antidepressant or psychotherapy or both, depending on the circumstances, can reveal within a relatively short period of time some changes, which then clues us into this. People, as they age, have sadness just like individuals do when they're younger. That's a normal part of the human condition. It really takes a trained individual in psychology or psychiatry to tease that apart. And the problem is not that we lack the skills to do that or the treatments. The problem is that people often won't go to get the treatment, or they're afraid to see someone feeling that they're going to be labeled in some way. But once we get above and beyond that stigma, the difference can be really spectacular.
We all know elderly people who can be on, you know, a dozen different medications for various conditions. Does throwing psychotropics into that mix change the way they work?
It can. There can be some really important side effects, which is exactly why seeing a specialist is so important.
Mm-hmm.
I work as a geriatric psychiatrist, which means that everyone I see is older. I'm familiar with the potential drug-drug interactions, and I can tailor the antidepressant or whichever medication is to the particular condition, or I can determine we really don't need medication and therapy is a better and more effective approach here. Often internists and other specialists can do the same thing right out the gate, but once the situation becomes a little more complex, it's really critical to have that specialist involved, and there certainly are individuals around with that training and expertise to do that.
There is a shortage, though, of people who have specialized in geriatric medicine, whether it's geriatric internal medicine, certainly geriatric psychiatry. What do you suggest to people who would like this sort of care for a loved one but have a hard time getting an appointment with a doctor?
It's true. Well, you have to be persistent mm-hmm. because there is a shortage, but there certainly are people around who have this expertise. And I often suggest not only seeing someone for medication management, but also someone who can provide either counseling or at least an overview of the situation, and try to identify whether there are some really practical concerns which can sometimes make a difference. I'll give you a perfect example. You might have the best medication that will help the depression, but if the person's not taking it or they don't have help with administering the medications, you've really lost out on that. So again, that's a really practical issue. Or maybe they need transportation to get to the appointment, and lacking that, they simply don't even get the help that they need. So it really takes persistence and creativity, and if you have to drive an hour and a half to see someone, sometimes you have to do that, but in the end, it's worth it, because a little bit of treatment at one point can have an important impact for years going forward.
We have an email here from Gracie who writes, I feel as if you're working with higher-level clientele. I deliver Meals on Wheels, and few have access to mental health help. Your patients are not the norm.
Well, I work right in the heart of Miami with as diverse a community from every standpoint, culturally, from a socioeconomic standpoint. And so I don't think there's any element of the community that I don't see through many different avenues. So I would really want to make that clear that I see everyone ranging from indigent individuals who have minimal access to care to individuals who have lots of resources. And to be honest with you, in the end, it doesn't really make a difference whether you have money or not, whether you have lots of resources or not. Everyone faces the same changes as they age, and everyone has the potential to respond to the same treatments as well.
What do you think about the written into the healthcare law is a provision that will allow people to pay for long-term care insurance? Will this be helpful to allow people to stay in their homes, maybe with some help, as opposed to if they don't quite need a long-term care facility?
Without question, that can be helpful. And unfortunately today, for a lot of individuals trying to navigate amongst a lot of the different long-term care insurances can be difficult, and people really don't know what to anticipate. And if you don't know what to anticipate, it's hard to know what's going to be the best policy. I'm certainly not an expert in that area, but it's critical for people to prepare ahead of time and realize that sometimes they do need help, and that a little help can really go a long way in terms of allowing them to maintain as much independence as possible and also to stay at home, which is often the best scenario for them.
Geriatric psychiatrist Mark Agronin works at Miami Jewish Health Systems, and he's the author of the new book, How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old. We'll resume our conversation with Mark in a couple of minutes. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is geriatric psychiatrist Mark Agronin. He works for Miami Jewish Health Systems and is the author of the book How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next on the phones to Frisco, and we'll speak with Donna. Hi, Donna.
Hi. I understand from an article in The Economist magazine that people have a U-shaped pattern to their life. That is, they're happiest when they're young than when they're very old. But the middle years are the hardest and saddest years. And I was wondering if your guest would comment on that.
Thanks for your call.
Sure. This is based on a very large survey by the Gallup organization that came out a few years ago. They polled over 340,000 individuals in a telephone survey, age 18 to 85. And they looked at levels of stress, worry, overall well-being. And what they found is that levels of stress and worry start off actually at their highest at the age of 18 and taper off and actually hit the lowest point by age 85. When they look at levels of well-being, they start off relatively high at age 18, hit a low point around the age of 50, and then increase and actually hit a peak, so the highest levels of well-being being reported at the age of 85. My guess is that if I were to offer any explanation here, that in middle age, people are facing the most amount of responsibilities in terms of career, in terms of being a caregiver, either for children or parents, and that is probably all these different responsibilities and managing them that might increase stress or worry, but certainly impair well-being. But that's a guess. I don't think we fully understand that. For me, the major take-home point from the study is how high well-being is in the 85-year-olds. Now, these are individuals who are facing all the same age-related changes that we would imagine in late life, and yet they're still reporting high levels of well-being, which is often the opposite of what we imagine later in life.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go this time to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. Something very interesting happened to me when I turned 40. I began to be more self-deprecating about my age, as if almost to sort of apologize for how old I'd become. And I was wondering if you could just talk generally about how our culture views aging. I mean, apparently in our culture, we'd prefer to look like we've had plastic surgery than look old. And just talk generally about that. Thank you very much.
Sure. Well, thank you for the question. Obviously, we're a youth-centered culture in so many different ways. And it's usually in our late 30s and early 40s when we begin to notice some of the physical changes that suggest we're aging. People lose more hair in that time. They begin to develop gray hairs around that time, keeping in mind that 100 years ago, the average lifespan was about 50. And so when you were in your 40s, you were actually considered quite old. I think a lot of this has to do with the messages that we send each other, not only in a day-to-day life, but also in the media, about what it means to grow old. We focus on what we're losing, what's declining, rather than on the strengths. So I would think about it this way. When you think about yourself in 40, think about how much more knowledge you have than when you were younger, all the experience that you've built up. My guess is that you're probably more emotionally mature at 40 than you were at 18 or 20. You have ways of thinking about things which probably are more practical, and this will only continue, something that we call wisdom. If you focus on these strengths and the opportunities that they give you, it will likely allow you to have certainly a better perspective on aging. And I would point out that I work with individuals in their 80s and 90s every day, so being 40 is barely even on the scale of things. I know sometimes people like to hear that. But you've got a long time ahead and lots of wonderful opportunities as well.
What do you notice that people who live to be 100 or more have in common?
Well, there's actually been a lot of research on this area. What they find is that, on the one hand, we've not identified a specific gene. There really is not an anti-aging gene that's ever been discovered. But these are individuals who, on the one hand, probably had a lower vulnerability to certain diseases, especially the main killers, being cancer and heart disease and stroke. Individuals, on the whole, tend to be more independent. They tend to be more positive and forward-thinking compared to individuals who have not made it to 100. These are some characteristics, but we've only really begun to study them and understand it. But you can bet that this will continue, because if you look at the last census records, the fastest single growing age in the country is 100. So we're seeing a lot more centenarians, and we certainly will study them more. The one thing that changes is, of course, what it means to be 100 now will change in 20 years. We will begin reaping the benefits of healthier lifestyles, and so it's always a changing process. And my guess is most of the listeners in their 40s and 50s will have an excellent chance of not only reaching 100, to be actually in pretty good physical and mental shape when they hit that point.
So 100 is the new 80, or will be?
Well, I hesitate to ever say that, but I guess you could make a case for that at some point.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Linda, waiting patiently in Fort Worth. Hi, Linda.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Pardon me?
Go ahead, please.
I just wanted to say that I just turned 70, but the way I see myself, the way I feel inside my head, and the way I relate to people is more like somebody in their mid-40s to 50. And I don't think I'm just deluding myself. I think that's actually the way I feel. When I'm with people my own age, I feel like they're older than me. So I just wondered if that's a common experience, that there's a difference in the outer shell and how you feel inside.
Sure, and it's becoming more common. And it's important that you should There's no rules about how you have to see yourself at 70. You can't let other people or what you might see on TV define what it means to be 70. Just think about how it's changed over time. If you turn back the clock to the 1950s, if you were 70, you were quite old, not just in terms of how people felt, but also physically. This is before we really knew much about the role of exercise and healthy diets. So I would encourage the way you look at things. And remember that you have choices, and how you view yourself, regardless of how old you are, is up to you. It's not a matter of denying reality. I think sometimes we imagine that, well, we have to delude ourselves to thinking that we're younger than we really are. It's not a matter of that. It's accepting your age, but again, realizing that you have a choice in terms of how you're going to view it and what opportunities you'll take advantage of. It's really, it's never too late to make certain considerations. I just had a 96-year-old man in my office recently with a long-standing history of depression, with marital issues. We've been working with him really intensely in psychotherapy, and he came in the other week and said, I have to tell you, doctor, my life has been turned around. And indeed, his depression is better. He's getting along better with his wife. His relationships with his extended family are better. And this is at 96. This is someone that could have easily been written off as too old to change, and I don't think he's the exception. I think increasingly he's more the rule.
Did you happen to catch Mick Jagger's performance on the Grammys last night?
I didn't.
It was pretty amazing. I mean, this guy's, I think he's about 70 years old, and it's just extraordinary the way he can move and dance, and obviously, despite a lack of clean living early on, you know, his attitude seems to be keeping him young.
Well, and we do need role models like that, because when you see that, you realize, hey, at 70, not that everyone can be a rock star at 70, but you can be the equivalent. And to me, the most wonderful thing is to see individuals try new pursuits. Not only is it wonderful for the development of their brain because they're challenging themselves, but in terms of their own personal development, they're exploring new things. We tend to look at the life cycle as hitting a peak in middle age and then declining. But one new model, and this has been proposed by Gene Cohen, who is one of the most prominent aging researchers, is he talks about the expansion of energy and creativity as we get older, that we have the potential, whether in a big way or sometimes in small ways, to still be vital and creative and meaningful within the context of our lives. And that's really a wonderful sense. The more we encourage that, the more role models we see, it's easier for people to realize that they can have the confidence to do the same thing.
Back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Bill in Richardson. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Chris. Member, daily listener, regular caller.
Thank you.
Love this topic. My mom just passed away in May, 96, and I'm an elementary school teacher for 30 years. And I didn't know how to be more successful in terms of relating to my mom until I learned something about the four-letter word love. And, you know, I rarely hear that word mentioned, and I never used that word. I never really understood it. And I think it's appropriate today's Valentine's Day. But I read a book by Greg Bear, and he was talking about real love. And I realized when I used those principles as far as loving my mom, it was more powerful than any medication or therapy.
Wow.
Because basically, that's what she needed in order to be happy.
I would
and
agree.
And then I did it on the kids, and the kids just soaked it up. And when you were talking about the curve as far as middle age and children and elderly people, I think no matter what age we are, no matter where we are in our life, if we're loved, we're far happier.
Bill, thank you so much for your call. I'm sorry for your loss, but let's get a comment from Mark. What do you think about that?
I would agree completely, and I've seen those transformations here in the nursing home. Individuals who are able to find new relationships and to fall in love with other individuals or to feel loved, and it's transforming. I speak to you as a physician, as someone steeped in the science of aging. Often people come to me for medications, and yet I can tell you, if you ask me at the end of the day, what is most healing for people, what brings the best relationships and the best outcome, you really hit on it. It's someone feeling valued, feeling loved, being able to share faith with someone. These make a difference. I had a man in my office yesterday. He's in a wheelchair. He has end-stage kidney disease. He's part of the Haitian community here, and we all know the terrible tragedy this community has faced. And he told me, he said, on the one hand, I'm suffering, but he said, I also have happiness too. And part of it comes from his faith. Part of it comes from the people who love him and that he loves. And this is one of the gifts of aging that we have, that we're able to still experience this in many different ways. So your point is so important, and the more we can focus on this, regardless of someone's situation in late life, it's always a better outcome.
I want to ask you this. Very often, very old people seem quite fragile to us, but they don't need and benefit from human touch any less than the rest of us, right?
It's a wonderful point. And this is what's so difficult. When some individuals go into an institution, the only time they're touched is sometimes in a rough way or during caregiving. It's not soothing for them. And so things like massage, pet therapy, or just having family come in and just holding a hand is important. And even though we don't fully understand it, I am certain that the stimulation of the nervous system and the release of hormones when someone is touched is a profound experience and contributes certainly to a person's well-being.
Do the patients who are in nursing home care, do they cope in different ways with the loss, inevitably, of new friends that they've made within the nursing home, lost to death?
Probably one, if I were to identify one of the most difficult aspects of growing old for many people is losing parents, losing spouses and friends, because these are the individuals with whom they've had the main connections in life. And when you're in your 90s, you've lost most of those individuals. And if you have children or grandchildren, that can help to some extent. But it doesn't mean that they can't make new relationships, but it's certainly more difficult. And people look at it in a different way. They tend to want to be very practical. And if they're going to start a relationship, it's something that they like to be very emotionally satisfying, and that's not always guaranteed. So I always encourage younger generations, especially grandchildren, to stay vitally involved with your elders. The impact on them is extraordinary, and in return, you will find the experience can be really transforming.
Are there best practices for younger people, maybe in middle age, to plan for their elder years?
Well, there's a lot we can do. The good news is that it doesn't take a lot of expense, and it doesn't take any fancy techniques, because there is no magic pill or potion in terms of aging well. But there's a few very simple, very basic points. Keeping physically active, moderate exercise makes an enormous difference in terms of keeping the brain healthy. Diets that are generally lower in fat, have lots of fruits and vegetables, and a source of omega-3 fatty acid can be very helpful as well.
Just about 5-10 seconds left.
Keeping socially active, these connections and relationships we have are really life-saving and can help us enjoy the aging process all the more so.
Mark Agronin's new book is How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old. Mark, thank you very much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.